We are now recording. Hear ye, hear ye. This Honorable Appellate Court for the Second Judicial District is now in session. The Honorable Leon C. Fremley presiding. Your Honors, the first case on the docket this morning is 2-21-0757. The people of the state of Illinois, plaintiff Appellee v. Manuel A. Flores, defendant appellate. Arguing for the appellant, Mr. Jed Stone. Arguing for the appellee, Ms. Lynn Harrington.
Mr. Stone, when you're ready, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Jed Stone, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Flores. I want to start by asking the question, what was offered as a factual basis for Mr. Flores? Because when we look at that, we see the basis of our claim for actual innocence.
Mr. Stone, interject a question.
Of course.
Before we get into the merits of the case, if you could address a preliminary matter. This is the matter before the court is a successive post-conviction petition, correct?
That is correct.
It's my understanding of reading the briefs and the state's argument that a motion was not filed with the trial court seeking leave to file a successive petition. Is that correct?
I think that Judge Shaines permitted us to file the successive petition. I did not file a written motion.
Okay, more to the point, the state, as you probably know, is asking us to strike and dismiss the petition, prepared to cite authority relative to the standards governing successive post-conviction petitions. So how do you respond to that argument?
My response is that this is a case of constitutional magnitude. The judge ignored the finding of Boykin versus Alabama, depriving Mr. Flores of his constitutional right to a fair plea, a knowledgeable waiver of his right to trial, and the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause. Those issues require this court to reverse the dismissal of Mr. Flores's petition and remand this cause for a stage two hearing.
Mr. Stone, does Boykin require a factual basis for a plea?
Well, Boykin says that no plea can be made without there being an actual face-to-face disclosure to the court that the accused who is entering a plea is doing so knowingly and intelligently and freely, that he understood. I'm sorry.
Okay, is there anything new that you've alleged that either counsel or your client didn't know at the time of the plea?
He is a Mexican national with limited English resources. But most importantly,
is there any allegation that there was no interpreter available to him?
No, there is not.
I just want to be clear. Okay.
The issue is, when the prosecutor said, that Mr. Flores did not set the fire, that Mr. Flores was not present when the fire was set, that Mr. Flores did not order others to set a fire, and in fact, Mr. Flores didn't even know that others had set a fire, all as part of the so-called factual basis for this plea, and the court accepted that as a factual basis, the record is clear that no factual basis to a crime of intent, a crime of knowledge, was made. And
but
so
accepting as true what you've just said, that was equally available in the original post-conviction petition. To Justice Jorgensen's question, what's new?
The only thing new is that it is clear that the state's reliance on Rule 402 is not the issue in this case. And the issue is a violation of the Constitution under the principles of Boykin. And Mr. Flores is entitled to a hearing on that constitutional violation, which is in fact a statement of actual innocence. Judge, as you know, the crime of aggravated arson has a mens rea of knowing or knowingly, being consciously aware. Absent evidence of being consciously aware of the setting of a fire, of the burning of a building, it is not an aggravated arson. And if it is not aggravated arson, then the record itself within the four corners of the record demonstrates actual innocence. That's the actual innocence claim that we're relying on.
Mr. Stone, are you making an attack on the sufficiency of the factual basis? It seems like that's what you're saying, is the court accepted a factual basis that really in reality didn't exist or something along those lines.
I'm saying that when a defendant is faced with a factual basis that is contrary to the law, his waiving his right to trial and entering a plea cannot be determined to be knowingly made. If it is not knowingly and intelligently made, it is a void plea. It is a violation of the 14th Amendment. And whether or not Rule 402 was mentioned or attempted to be adhered to, that's not the issue in this case. Of course, a violation of Rule 402 may not be in and of itself a constitutional violation, and therefore a violation of a Supreme Court rule in and of itself without more may not be the basis of a post-conviction petition. We are not saying that this is a violation of 402. We are saying this is a violation of due process and the right to plead knowingly and intelligently. And the basis of that is the Supreme Court's opinion in Boykin versus Alabama. I know that there is, and we told you in our brief that there is a Fourth District case, Weiser, People versus Weiser, that holds that the requirements of Supreme Court Rule 402 are not constitutionally mandated. We also told you that Justice Craven had a dissent in that case, where he says essentially that, well, rather than guess, let's quote him. In my view, it is constitutionally impermissible to accept a plea of guilty without first ascertaining a factual basis for the plea. Justice Craven's statement is, I think, thoughtful and clear. That's exactly what happened in this case. And while the majority disagreed with him, but the basis of the majority's opinion was a confabulation of 402 with constitutional rules, the really holding precedent is the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Boykin versus Alabama. The constitutional basis of Mr. Flores's claim is the Boykin ruling of the Supreme Court. Manuel Flores is innocent of the offense of aggravated arson. The court failed to establish that there was a factual basis for a plea, and that failure to establish a factual basis for the plea demands that this court grant him relief by remanding this cause for a stage two hearing. Are there other questions that the court may have?
I have no additional questions at this time.
So if I'm part of a gang hierarchy and I order somebody to do this
SOS,
to do an SOS, and I don't give any details or direction as to what that SOS should look like. And that person goes out and, you know, runs him over with a car or injures him in a very serious fashion. How am I not accountable, even though I had no idea what the exact course of conduct was going to be?
Well, you may be accountable in your case because the factual basis would set up a theory of accountability. The problem with the state's argument in their brief, citing the two cases that they cited.
Hernandez.
I'm sorry, give me a moment. Fernandez and Salazar, those cases are exactly the kind of case that you described, where the defendant was accountable. We distinguished those cases in our reply brief, and I think distinguished them clearly. This case is a case where the state said in its factual basis, the only evidence we have in this case, that Flores didn't set the fire. Flores was not present when the fire was set. Flores did not order others to set a fire. And Flores didn't know that others had set a fire. If the crime is a specific knowledge required mens rea, and he had no knowledge of any of those things, then the factual basis for that crime was never made. And when presented with those facts, Mr. Flores did not and could not have knowingly and intelligently waived his right to remain silent, to a fair trial, to waive trial, all constitutional rights under the 14th Amendment and under Boykin.
Thank you. I have no further questions. Justice Hudson or Justice Jorgensen?
I do not.
I have nothing else.
Thank you, judges.
All right, you'll have an opportunity for rebuttal, Mr. Stone. Ms. Harrington.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Lynn Harrington, and I represent the people of the state of Illinois. Your Honors, I first would like to address the procedural part of this case that I disagree with opposing counsel. Judge Shaines made it very clear in his order that where we're at here is a motion for leave to file a successive post-conviction petition. And he did a very thorough job in setting out his analysis and why it was properly denied. So even if this court agrees with opposing counsel, the proper remedy would be to remand to allow him to file a successive post-conviction petition. That aside, I'd like to next address counsel's argument with regard to legal accountability and note that this court in 2014 in People versus Salazar set out the law of accountability in Illinois and made it quite clear that there are two bases of legal accountability. What opposing counsel is talking about is the first type, where a defendant shared a criminal intent with the principal. That's not what this case is about. This case is a clear case of common criminal design. Common criminal design happens when a person aids another in the planning or commission of an offense, then he's legally accountable. And he doesn't have to engage in the planning of the exact offense. What happened here was the defendant set out an SOS, a smash on sight. He didn't say what to do. In fact, in some of the documents attached to the successive post-conviction petition, it notes that the defendant said, get creative. So when Elver Hernandez decided to ask his brother to help, and they put together a Molotov cocktail and threw it into Rafael Juarez's home, the defendant was legally accountable for those actions in killing that 12-year-old boy and severely injuring two other people.
Ms. Harrington, if I can interject the question, Mr. Stone raises an interesting point. Where the defendant issues or orders an SOS, does he become legally accountable for anything and everything that happens after that without limitations?
Yes, Your Honor, he does, because he is planning with Elver Hernandez to commit an offense. So he is legally accountable.
We're simply giving an order. Where's the planning part of it?
The planning part of it is giving the order for the offense itself to smash on site. He's telling him, go over there and give him what they call a violation because he wasn't showing up at meetings and he was trying to get out of the Latin Kings and join another gang. So he was telling him, take care of this guy, smash on site, get creative with it. There's your offense. So when Elver Hernandez got creative with it and decided to use a Molotov cocktail, that's classic common criminal design. I'd like to next touch on Boykin versus Alabama, where counsel talks about that it is controlling in this case. It is very clear, Your Honors, that Boykin versus Alabama was about the voluntariness of a plea, not about a factual basis. Now, at oral argument, counsel seems to be turning his argument more towards a voluntary, lack of voluntary entering into a guilty plea. That's not what he argued on in his brief. He argued that there was an inadequate factual basis. And this court, way back in 1975, talked about Boykin versus Alabama in People versus Pate and say Boykin versus Alabama had nothing to do with a factual basis. And a factual basis does not sound in a constitutional violation. And if it doesn't sound in a constitutional violation, then it can't be in a post-conviction petition, let alone a successive post-conviction petition. The Fourth District also said the same thing in People versus Weiser. However, even if this court does decide that the factual basis issue does sound in constitutionality for the purposes of a post-conviction petition, the supporting documents were insufficient as a matter of law, Your Honors. In an actual innocence claim, defendant has to prove that the documents attached to his successive post-conviction petition were new, material and non-cumulative, and most important, of such a character that it would probably result in a different result if it went to trial. There's no such documents attached. An overwhelming majority of them are investigative police reports from 2009, which actually hurt the defendant much more than help him. The new ones are simply reports, and one of them is a newspaper article from Florida. It's talking about the Latin Kings and RICO charges against them and everything they're involved in. But as Judge James pointed out, it has nothing to do with this defendant. It has nothing to do with these crimes. So there's nothing in these documents that would help the defendant or prove an actual innocence claim whatsoever. So as a matter of law, there's nothing here. In addition, the defendant has waived these claims because case law is clear that when you voluntarily plead guilty to a fully negotiated plea, you've waived any claim of error whatsoever. So for all these reasons, Your Honor, there was no error here. Judge Shaines properly denied defendant's leave to file a successive post-conviction petition. Are there any more questions?
Well, Ms. Harrington, if I, you know, your statement, a voluntary plea would waive any claims of error, but counsel's argument is that without a proper factual basis, it could not have been a voluntary plea.
With regard to the factual basis, Your Honor, it is a very thorough factual basis, simply because the prosecutor was doing a very good job in saying the defendant did not order this specific Molotov cocktail. He set out the accountability. He set out the criminal design that the defendant, in fact, was the one who ordered the smash on site. The defendant, in fact, was the one who told Elver, go ahead, go over and do an SOS on Rafael Juarez. That's a factual basis for a common criminal design under the law of accountability that's clearly laid out in People versus Salazar by this court.
Bless you.
Thank you. I do not have any additional questions, Justice Jorgensen or Justice Hudson, do you?
I have nothing in addition.
I do not.
All right, Ms. Harrington, thank you. Mr. Stone.
Thank you again, Judge. I think that Justice Jorgensen answered the government's position that voluntary plea of guilty is a waiver of constitutional claims. That's true as stated, but it is our position that this was anything but a voluntary plea of guilty. It was a 14th Amendment Boykin violation of the plea of guilty, for which there must be some constitutional review by this reviewing court. The purported
So, Mr. Stone, your position, if I understand it, is that you cannot voluntarily plead guilty where the factual basis as a matter of law does not support the crime to which you are pleading guilty to.
I think that's exactly well stated, Judge.
Well, let me ask this then. As to the state's argument that you're not focusing on the common criminal design theory underlying accountability, can you address that, please?
That's where I was going next. Thank you. I think that Justice Hudson asked a pertinent question. Where is the planning? There was no evidence that Mr. Flores in any way helped the brothers plan this crime. He may have communicated an SOS, a smash on sight, from an Inca higher up to a street level person. But that's no planning of an offense. And in fact, the factual basis showed that there was no planning, which gets to the state's argument that the supporting documents are insufficient. The supporting documents, you can disclose, you can ignore all of the things appended to the post-conviction petition alleging actual innocence and look only within the four corners of the record. The factual basis for the plea was that Flores didn't set the fire. Flores wasn't present when the fire was set. Flores did not order others to set the fire. In fact, Flores didn't even know that they had made a Molotov cocktail and were going to set the fire. This cannot be sustained as a planned Salazar type accountability. He is not accountable for their actions when they went beyond what they were told to do by the Inca. And in any event, Mr. Flores being a conduit between the Inca and the street level people did not plan, design, or execute a crime with them. The facts of Salazar are very different from the flat facts here. The facts of the other case cited by the people are even more different than the facts here. When we say that Mr. Flores didn't set a fire, wasn't present when the fire was set, didn't order others to set a fire, and that he didn't know that others had set the fire, we are saying that any plea accepted by the trial court with those facts deprived Mr. Flores of his constitutional right to a knowing and intelligent plea. It was an involuntary plea, and this case should be remanded for a stage two hearing. In the event that the court wants to take the people up on their suggestion, then you could remand this case with the instruction that I file a successive post-conviction petition. And of course, we're prepared to do that if that is your decision.
Is it possible for the state to respond to that comment?
No.
Okay, thank you, sorry.
In a word?
So, but Mr. Stone, so isn't the common criminal design, the idea is, look, so let's just take your events as you describe it. I mean, the defendant is part of a chain that gives this order, do the smash and grab, be creative. And the common design, the plan is commit a smash and grab, punish Juarez for, you know, not following gang protocols or rules or however you want to put it, you know, get him back in line. What flowed from that was this admitted situation where the defendant was not aware of the specifics, but isn't the point of the common criminal design theory underlying accountability that he doesn't have to know the details? He set this in motion and bears the responsibility. Isn't that the point?
I don't think that is the point. And if we looked back to the facts of Salazar, at least as I remember them, that Salazar and his co-defendants were driving around together. I think they were looking for cars to break into. In that set of facts, it's clear that Mr. Salazar and his co-defendants had a single united purpose, that they were working together to accomplish that purpose, and that that is accountability. Here, the act that Mr. Flores is guilty of is communicating an order for a smash on site, an SOS. It had nothing to do with the knowing element of the offense of aggravated arson. The legislature told us that in order to be guilty of an arson, you had to knowingly start a fire. You had to knowingly damage property or a home.
And under your theory, if we change go to one of the terrorism offenses that we have in Illinois, under your theory, if I say to somebody who's under me in an organization, on this date, I want you to go commit a terrorist act, and I give no indication of what the terrorist act is, and this person turns around and, you know, blows up a building, I mean, I'm guilty of that, even though I had no clue which terrorist act they were going to commit, is under the common criminal design rule. Do you disagree with that?
No, I don't. But that's not what we have here. We don't have an instruction, go commit a terrorist act.
No, we have an instruction, go commit a smash on site and be creative.
So a smash on site in the parlance means go beat this guy up. It doesn't mean burn his house down. It doesn't mean make a Molotov cocktail. It doesn't mean throw a Molotov cocktail through the window of a house. It doesn't mean any of those things. He didn't intend or know that that was what was going to be done. And the crime for which he is charged is not terrorism. It is aggravated arson. And in order to be guilty of an arson, you have to know the act is about to take place. You have to have planned that act to be taking place. It is different with respect to a terrorist act, because the legislature has defined it and defined the elements of the crime as different. And here, those elements were never met and never proven in a factual basis.
Thank you. Justice Jorgensen or Justice Hudson, any additional questions for Mr. Stone?
No, sir.
I have none. Thank you.
I would like to thank both parties for interesting arguments. And we are going to take this under advisement and issue an opinion in due course. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both. Thank you.